You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So we wanted to do a leftovers episode, things that were left in the legal pad from the episodes on the student loan history episode. We had to go into the cost of education as well as the student loan history, which is almost two different things, but so related I could not do separate episodes because otherwise you just keep on getting questions about the one when you talk about the other. That made it long. Whenever something's long, there's a few things that's left on the legal pad. I want to thank you for your support, whether you're on the Patreon or one of the original premium podcast subscribers. It really is helpful. Can't say it enough. That helps a lot. Yes, we have advertising on My History Computer Beer Politics. It doesn't totally replace the support from listeners. It's good. I still don't see this as a full-time. So we started the student loan episode with a discussion about Sputnik, and I wanted to do that. I think it's important because Sputnik essentially launched the student loan financing system, the first grants, which then became loans. And what I was thinking about ending the article with, we began with Sputnik. I wanted to end with Sputnik with the story of what happened in 1962. So it's 1957 when we first learn of Sputnik. In 1962, in the town of Manitowoc, Wisconsin, there's two police officers out on patrol, and they see this large chunk of metal in the middle of the street. They think it's cardboard. Yeah, but it's obstructing, so they get out of their cars and they, you know, go to pick it up. Now, you know, they see that it's metal and it's too hot for them to touch, to move. So they bring over local experts from a foundry and a shipyard who start examining it. They eventually have to send it over to the Smithsonian and they find that this is Sputnik. So Sputnik falls out of the sky in 62 and lands in the middle of Wisconsin. There's nothing there now. All that's there is a ring in the road that marks where this chunk was found. And the town of Manitowoc now has a Sputnik Fest on a regular basis where you can party and celebrate that Sputnik landed there. It was 7 tons. There's a dummy cosmonaut in it. That all burned up in the atmosphere. So it's a 20-pound hunk of metal that falls on Wisconsin. Oddly enough, it falls right outside the Rahr West Art Museum. So the Sputnik comes down, and this is what makes for the town like think, oh, we got to have a celebration about this. Going back to 62, when the cops find this, they start to realize what they've got. They do a Geiger counter to see if it has any radioactivity. They consult NASA. They offer it eventually back to the Soviets. And the Russians kind of make a big deal of it, and eventually take it as they're wont to do. We do make replicas of it. And to this day, the town of Manitowoc says, Sputnik landed here. Why don't you? Again, on the student loan episode, I wanted to talk a bit more about the New York Times article that was a source for Boston University building the super dorm and this issue of building big residential centers for students. One of the things that I wanted to make sure is that we avoided some of the common, really quick statements about political issues. I mean, if anything, that's what My History Computer Peer Politics is here for, to delve in a bit, because you know, you could see really quickly that people say, well, call costs to go up, just stay at home and commute. And look, I mean, that's a valid choice. It's an option for many people. It's going to reduce a student's cost if that student stays at home, essentially, and commutes to school. It's also going to severely limit the educational choices they have. So Americans enjoy more educational choices because there are student residences set up with colleges, but it obviously increases the cost. And you don't have as much of this in some other countries. But I wanted to point out that there's some historical tenets behind it, that it was very important to Thomas Jefferson, for instance, where students lived. And it also was important to Woodrow Wilson, though nobody really cares much about what Woodrow Wilson thought these days, but to the extent that they do, you know, there's two presidents that thought that where students live was just as important. So it's not incidental. It's not an extra cost. But people may be going a little crazy with what those things are. Here's more about dorms from the early 1990s. At the same time, other schools are phasing out TV lounges, game rooms, and study areas because students are bringing so much of their own equipment, from stereos to TVs to powerful computers, scanners, color printers, fax machines, and satellite dishes. I mean, this was going on when I went to college, which would have been 1989. I remember bringing a typewriter to college, but one of the things we had was a shared computer room, and it was large, extensive. You needed at that time to provide computers. Young people didn't just have laptops. That was very rare. Very rare, even in going into the early 90s, people didn't have laptops. They didn't even have a lot of electronic typewriters to have, like a Brother typewriter or something like that. That was kind of rare. I had brought a manual typewriter to college. I quickly ditched it and started using the computer room where there was, you know, adequate computers for the student body to use as needed. So you're seeing dwindling demand for certain shared facilities as people, you don't need a TV lounge when people are bringing TVs. Colleges are focusing on putting in a lot of new electrical outlets, as many as four times what older dormitories have, not to mention extra data jacks and cable TV plugs. But after spending all this money on new dorms, universities are far less tolerant than ever of students applying their own quirky home design visions to their room. Melinda Roberts, a Yale senior, used lots of green paint, plants, wall hangings, and stuffed monkeys to transform her dorm last year into a jungle room. She's disappointed by this year's digs, a brand new suite with private kitchen and bathroom. In the new dorm, you can't paint the walls and you can't bring furniture. It's all supplied. All the rooms are identical. It will be a challenge to make it livable. In keeping with the larger societal trend, colleges have been vigilantly cracking down on crime. Often this has simply meant more surveillance cameras and guards. But UCLA, seeking less intrusive methods, is constructing a new dormitory along the principles of defensible space, small village-like clusters of dorms, rather than impersonal high-rises, with highly visible public areas and doormen, rather than security guards. The way that the space is designed allows for self-policing, says Charles Oakley, the campus architect. Other schools are experimenting with higher-tech security devices. You know, I just wanted to say, of course, that's easy for UCLA, or not easy, but it's easier for Los Angeles, where there's tends to be more spread out, more wide, and less high space. You know, try that in a New York City. It's not possible. In NYU's new dorms, for example, students gain admission to the building by placing their hands against an optical scanner that takes 96 measurements and checks them against a database. On a couple of campuses in the South, students are opting for a walkmate, a beeper-sized device with three panic buttons to contact university police officers and alert them to any of the students' pre-existing medical conditions. $54 a semester plus a $25 activation fee. My dad has given me dorm alarms, stun gun, pepper spray, and mace, says Elizabeth Logan, a University of South Florida student who signed up for the Walkmate service. I'm not paranoid, but I think my dad is. So a little more about the midterms as well. One of the things I'm not sure I hit well, sometimes you do a podcast, it's not until you're listening to it that you're like, could have made this point better, is on Nixon in 1970. But I think I'll correct it by later in the fall doing an episode on the 1970 midterms. If you ask me, I put it in the realm of this kind of stave midterms, where Nixon didn't lose badly. It's just that Nixon, like Bush, the point I made on the podcast, Nixon in 1970 Bush in 1990 goes into a midterm aggressively seeking to gain seats. That's something that's very different from now. If you look at it, presidents now go into midterms in a very defensive mode. They're not thinking about gaining seats in the House because they know this midterm trend is so well established. And I think it's funny. I had a quick discussion with Bill Scherer, the journalist who wrote an article in the Washington Monthly about midterms, about this trend. And, you know, and one of the things that's interesting is that, so you have presidents gaining seats in only the elections of 1932, 1998, and 2002. But what's 1934, I should say, is that first election, 2002, 1998. But what's interesting about that, right? Two of them are in the last 30 years. So is something new going on? Is, for instance, the presence of, say, cable TV and then evolving into the internet and this kind of better coverage of politics changing things? Or is the discovery of the midterm trend and the that there is something out there to buck, has that lead to more bucking of it? There isn't enough sample size yet with just two of them. We would need that 2022 midterm to turn into, say, a stave election where, let's say, the Democrats gain seats to prove anything. But if it does turn that it's very different, I think you have to look at midterms differently. And we don't have that same trend that we used to have. But so far, things are playing right out. I mean, the Obama presidency just showed you that. The midterm trend, well in effect. Bush got hit with a midterm in his second midterm, even though he had a stave in his first one right after 9/11. Right now, it's looking like you need a hugely popular president and a crisis that all Americans agree is a crisis to have a president do fairly well in a midterm. So usually you're going to lose seats. It's going to come down to how many. You know, if Biden loses, say, 7 or 8 seats, Democrats will lose the House. It's going to be very hard to even elect a speaker. They will, but then it's going to be very hard to control one party. All you need is a few people to walk to the other side. And while the GOP party is pretty good at control right now, at regulating things, well, you've seen they had people in this House, Cheney and others, who didn't agree with leadership on a lot of things. And that's not going to change, even with those folks out, possibly. It's not going to change. You will have people that disagree with the speaker. That's hard when you're only controlling things by a few votes, as Democrats know now. So we'll see what happens in that midterm. But one thing we didn't represent Nixon exactly right.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
What Nixon did in the 1970 midterms, after they happened, and it was just a glancing blow for him, is go out there and, like Coolidge, he claimed victory. That's his public statement. It's just, I was so aware recording it already from Richard Reeves' book, President Nixon, and some other things, that privately he was telling his aides, like, this is horrible. This is terrible. You know, what a disaster. And he started blaming people, particularly Spiro Agnew, who was the main campaigner for the 1970 midterms. We'll get more into 1970 in an episode coming up. I have a lot of good stuff on that, and it'll be when it really hits midterm season in October, maybe we'll do it. But I did want to represent that Nixon, like Coolidge, was one of them that publicly went out there and said, actually, this is a win for us. And I didn't represent that. So you miss a few things, not hugely important. The other thing is on the 1990 budget deal. And in some outfits, it was called the deal of the century. And then in some more Republican outfits, it was called a disaster. And it's important to understand this happens in 1990, right around the time, right before the midterm, that Democrats and Republicans reach a deal. It is intended to reduce the deficit. President Bush, who's in Honolulu when the deal is made, says all political points of view have been sacrificed to bring this agreement about. Needless to say, I don't like raising taxes, never will. But there's a price to divided government. In other words, he's saying, look, we don't own Congress. If you want me to, like many presidents, Woodrow Wilson, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, many presidents have said it. Look, if you want me to run, give me a Democratic Congress. And Bush assures that he's going to absolutely hold the line on taxes from here on out. Two bells ring through the Capitol. Red-eyed representatives walk to a chamber for the final budget vote. The budget vote occurs at 6:58 a.m. on a Saturday, after hours and hours of negotiating. The party whips, who had been counting and recounting all night, stood in the doorways to buttonhole the undecided one last time. The three budget negotiators from the White House, John Sununu, White House Chief of Staff, Richard Darman, the budget director, and Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady, sat stone-faced in the visitor's galley watching the proceedings and watching the computerized tally. Afterward, asked how he felt, Mr. Darman wiped his forehead and said merely, "Woo." The drama was winding down today, and it began October 5th when a budget negotiated by President Bush advisors and top congressional leaders over eight arduous weeks was summarily rejected by the House, forcing a weekend-long shutdown of the government. Since then, there's been a political carnage that no one would have predicted in the heady days of midsummer, when Mr. Bush was cruising along at 75% approval ratings. In the last few weeks, the vast majority of Republicans in the House and many of the Senate broke ranks with their president. George Mitchell of Maine, the Democratic leader, summed up the ordeal. Can the government govern? Can the Congress act? Can elected officials ask any sacrifice at the present to secure the future? He said now, Congress answered yes. In 1 week, the president reversed course almost as many times as the Concorde, flying back and forth across the Atlantic. Democrats, smelling Republican blood, staked their party's reputation for days on a largely symbolic proposal, eventually dropped, that would have placed a surtax on the 60,000 Americans who earn more than $1 million a year, while the president's accused Democrats of being on a spending binge. All in all, we've got a package that I think Congress would say we wouldn't do in 100 years, Bob Dole of Kansas said. Richard Gephardt of Missouri, Democratic leader, said, if we fail, it will be said in Europe and Japan, all over the world, that the world's greatest democracy no longer has the will to govern. Representative David Obie of Wisconsin was a liberal Democrat who led scores of his allies to abandon the budget deal, complaining that it did not shift enough of the burden to the super rich. Representative Dick Armey of Texas said that the bill would generate more than $1 trillion in taxes over the next 5 years. I don't consider it a good deal. I was elected to represent the people who hired me, not to govern them. Just 47 Republicans vote for the bill. 180 Democrats vote for it. 74 Democrats vote against. 126 Republicans vote against. So Dick Armey is going to be one of the leaders in the Congress that is taken over by Republicans in 94 and Speaker Newt Gingrich. And I think this bill and Reagan's tax reform of 1986 are on their minds as things they no longer want to do these type of compromises. And you really have the arch conservatives of the party taking over. This budget deal also creates some problems for certain Democratic senators that are in close re-election races. Max Baucus of Montana, Bill Bradley in New Jersey, where we talked about the governor there had instituted a state income tax that was caused a citizens revolt. Paul Simon in Illinois, Tom Harkin in Iowa, Claiborne Bell in Rhode Island. Some of your staunch liberals are facing tough re-elects and vote against this bill. So it's really contentious. Newspaper in Tampa Bay just has this headline that has $1 trillion written out. So it's like 1,200,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, how much they're spending, $1.2 trillion. 10 inches thick, weighs 24 pounds, this budget deal. You know, nobody talks about how big the margins are in these bills. Anyway, so you see that that 1990 budget deal was the event of those midterms. And probably after I did a little more looking through some of the news coverage about that budget deal, it was probably more significant than even I had represented on the episode. There are two points of view on that budget deal and its long-term effects. Some think that it led to the deficit being reduced and eventually interest rates coming down. That is actually to be credited to Bush, although Bill Clinton was in office. You have some sources saying that 1990 budget deal led to the 1990s boom. I think that's a stretch, but that's always what happens. And then you have the Cato Institute, who a few years after the deal just said it was exploded the deficit. Exploded the deficit. News came out that President Trump had maybe strongly coincidental and probable ordered the IRS to audit James Comey and Andrew McCabe, who he didn't like very much because of the Russia investigation. You know, if it's true, it's like we see this again and again. I did an episode on this. I will be replaying that episode with some commentary. We've got to do something to insulate the IRS from presidents. It's, you know, Nixon, Truman, presidents throughout history have used the IRS to target political opponents. It's just not right. It causes a lot of problems for people. You know, you have even some conservative figures who let's say Nixon didn't like, you know, all of a sudden they'd end up with audits. Paula Jones was a former state employee of Arkansas, sued President Clinton, found herself a target of an audit from the IRS. So this, and this is extremely common, and there are more documented cases where we act. So it's something that there has to be maybe some artificial intelligence could be used, some type of algorithms instead of making personal decisions as to who to audit. And then that would be something you could trace in the computer system and could be transparent to how the decision was made to audit someone versus a president's political opponents always seeming to end up with audits. It's something we've got to find a way to insulate the IRS from your day-to-day politics. Now, Commissioner Redding has stated unequivocally he has no communication with President Trump, and the research audits are statistically generated. This, according to Kevin Brady, the Ways and Means ranking member, congressman from Texas.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.